After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee, for he did not want to walk in Judea, because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' feast of tabernacles was at hand. Now as we enter into John chapter 7 here, it is entering into an important part of Jesus' ministry. As we start in John 7, we're actually getting into the last 6 months now of Jesus' life and his ministry here. And as we look at this chapter, we're dealing primarily with the Feast of Tabernacles. That is the central theme and the thing that we're revolving around in this chapter here. The Feast of Tabernacles that was taking place in Jerusalem. And we know that many people came into the city to observe this feast. And this feast incorporated two specific ceremonies. One was pouring water from the pool of Siloam onto the altar in the temple, and the other one was lighting these lamps in and around the temple area in the courts of the temple. And it's interesting how these are two things that are central to the Feast of Tabernacles. And here Jesus is going to be, later on in this chapter, declaring, if anyone is thirsty, come unto me. He's already declared that, hasn't he, with the woman at the well. And then in chapter 8, he's going to say, I am the light of the world. Two specific ceremonies that took place in the Feast of Tabernacles, which is really ultimately fulfilled in Jesus Christ. And as we look at this chapter, we are going to be just really focusing in on this feast and the events around it. We're going to just get through half of this chapter today, but to give you a bit of an outline of this chapter, we are going to see the beginning of the feast and the disbelief that was there before the feast or the beginning of the feast. Then we'll look at the middle of the feast, and we'll be looking at the debate that was taking place. In the last part of the chapter, we'll look at the end of the feast and see the division that was beginning to arise. The beginning of the feast, the middle, and the end. Disbelief, debate, and division. Now, it says, after these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. Now, there has been much that has been taking place and much has been happening in the life of Jesus and in his ministry since he was last in Judea. He was last in Judea there in chapter 5. Remember when he went down there to the sheep gate and into the pool there, where there was that lame man that sat there by the pool, saying, I want to get in there. First people in the water, when the water was stirred, would be healed. He was waiting. And he went and ministered there. Then later on in the chapter, he was there in Judea, and the people were causing an uproar against Jesus, healing on the Sabbath. And we'll get more into that later on here. But since that chapter 5, remember last week we're in chapter 6, and he was there up again in Galilee, where he fed the 5,000. He went across the Sea of Galilee and is ministering there. Now, since he was last in Judea, as I said, there has been a lot of things that have been taking place. In fact, there's been about 2 years that has passed now. And John is not being very descriptive in writing everything that's taking place. We read about those things that Jesus did and the things that he said and different things that happened in his life in the other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. But again, John is being very selective in what he is recording, because he is simply recording those things to show Jesus as the Son of God. So, a lot of things have been taking place. Now, the Jews, it says in verse 1, that he did not want to walk in Judea because the Jews sought to kill him. Now, this stemmed from that healing that took place there with the paralytic, whatever disease he had, that was sitting by the pool of Siloam, by the sheep gate, the pool of Bethesda. And the Jews were very, very upset. They were angry. They were just in an uproar because Jesus did this healing on the Sabbath day. And of course, the Jews instructed that there was nothing to be done on the Sabbath. You were not allowed to do anything. You weren't allowed to carry anything, make anything, do nothing on the Sabbath. So along comes Jesus and he does this healing. And well, you know, that did not go over too well with the Jews. And it says there in chapter 5, verse 16, for this reason the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him because he had done these things on the Sabbath. Incredible, isn't it? So, Jesus, of course, spent much of his ministry up north in the area of Galilee, where he ministered and where he taught. And we saw that there in chapter 6, didn't we? And so, we see that the Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. It was coming close. Now, the Feast of Tabernacles was one of the three major feasts that all Jewish males were required to attend each year. There was the Feast of Passover and Pentecost, and then the Feast of Tabernacles. And those were the three major feasts that they all had to be in attendance to. They all had to make their pilgrimage down to Jerusalem, you know, wherever they were living. And so we talked even last week in chapter 6 how many of the Jews might have been there in Galilee because they were making their way down to Jerusalem. So the crowds could have even been greater than normally they would have been when he was feeding the 5,000. Now this feast took place in late September or early October, and it lasted for 8 days. It started on the Sabbath and it ended on the Sabbath as well. And the last day was the biggest day of them all. Now, this feast was a commemoration of the time that the Israelites spent wandering through the wilderness when they were ushered out of Egypt, crossed the Red Sea, and Moses was leading them. It was the 40 years that they spent wandering in the wilderness where the Lord protected them and the Lord provided for them. And as they were wandering through the wilderness, they would have to pitch these tents that they would camp out under the stars. And so this Feast of Tabernacles, or otherwise known as the Feast of Booths, was in remembrance and commemorated the time that their forefathers spent wandering through the wilderness. So the Jews, what they would do is during this week-long festival there in Jerusalem, is they would all construct these little booths or these lean-tos, these shelters that they would construct together, and they would camp out basically for that week. Has anybody ever been to like Sunfest or Jesus Northwest or those big group things where you just tented out? Ryan's been there. Joe, you've been there. All right, great.
Oswego.
Where's that at?
It's a racetrack.
There you go. These big Christian festivals, you know. And it's neat. You see all these people. We got these. At Jesus Northwest, we used to go there every year, and they'd have this big field, and everybody would just go, and it'd be this Christian concert thing. And everybody would just go and pitch their tents, and you look out over the field, and you just see tarps and tents and stuff, and it was great. We used to go and bring these like water balloon launchers that you'd have like these surgical tubing things, and just you could launch them for like a football field length, that kind of thing. So you could bomb something on the other side of camp and they wouldn't know who it was. So it was really cool, actually. Just, you know, remembering my childhood. Okay. But I digress, so let's move on. And so the people, that was actually last year, but anyways, the people would go and build these little lean-tos or shelters. And the fathers and the families would be all camped out under there. And the kids, you know, they'd be sitting there going, "Dad, you know, what are we doing out here? Why aren't we there in our house, you know, watching TV in the nice warmth and comfort and everything?" And they'd be sitting there, "Dad, why are we out here?" And, they'd be able to say, "Well, my son, you know, this is the way that our forefathers, when they traveled through the wilderness, as God brought them out of Egypt and led them into the promised land, this is what they would do. They'd camp out under the stars. Look, son, see the stars that are shining up there." And so it was a way to remember the things that they went through. And it was a way of also teaching the children and stuff. And so they'd be able to pass down what was taking place. Now, as I said earlier, there were two other traditions or ceremonies that were added at a later date. And that was the taking of the water from the pool of Siloam. And the priest would go down and fill up these big jugs or barrels or these pitchers and fill them up with water, and they would go and take them to the altar and pour it out on the altar. And that was a way of remembering the water that came from the rock there at Horeb, when Moses went and struck the rock and water came out, showing that God provided for them. And so they take this water to typify that. And then also, I said, there was the other ceremony, and that was the lighting of lamps in and around the temple courts. And they would do that each night, and that was a way of also remembering how the Lord guided them by what at night? A pillar of fire. That pillar of fire, and so as they were wandering through the desert, the Lord was always going before them, the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. And so as they lit those lamps, they're able to say, and remember how there in the wilderness, the Lord would just guide them by that fire, by that light at night. And so this feast, it was a long one, drawn out throughout the week. But this feast was probably one of the most popular and one of the most important feasts after the captivity. Josephus talks about how this was one of the most popular ones. People would come excited about it. The city was really basically visibly transformed and changed, and people would enter into it with just excitement, with thanksgiving and with rejoicing. And it lasted throughout the feast. It was a wonderful, popular feast, and people were excited about it. They would rejoice and with thanksgiving throughout it. And so this is the scene that we see happening there in Jerusalem as it is at hand. So his brothers therefore said to him, "Depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." So along comes Jesus' half-brothers. They were his half-brothers because we know that Jesus did not have a part with Joseph, just born through Mary and, of course, conceived by the Holy Spirit. So these were his half-brothers. And Matthew chapter 13 names them for us. They were James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas. Now, the brothers come along. They've no doubt grown up with Jesus, seen him grow up from a little boy into the person that he is now. And there was, I'm sure, a lot of buzz going around, Jesus doing these signs, people wondering, is he the Messiah? Could this be the one? And the disciples come to him and say, "Listen, Jesus, here's the deal. You know, if you are the Messiah, as you say you are, well then just go and make your way down to the feast. People are coming all around from different areas. The city is going to be so packed with people." It was rumored that there were just millions of people that would come there. It was busy. And the brothers are thinking, "Jesus, you need to go down there so that your disciples may see the works that you're doing." And they thought, no one who claims to be who you are would go and just do these things in secret. No, you go and do it openly. Let it be known. Now the brothers here, they were exercising a worldly wisdom, weren't they? They thought, if you're the Messiah, you need to make yourself known. And they were simply looking at it from a worldly perspective, thinking, if you are the Messiah, the one that's going to bring in the kingdom, well, we've got to have a big parade. We've got to come in with authority. You've got to make yourself known. We've got to have banners. We've got to have music, hoopla, everything. And you see, that's the way that the world would have done it, right? And it's interesting that there is a worldly wisdom that Christians even today can get caught up in. Christians can think, well, this is how the world does it. Maybe this is what I need to do in my life. You know, if I'm going to advance in my workplace, well, I've got to get a little cutthroat here. I might have to do a little backstabbing just to climb that corporate ladder. That's what the world is doing. So, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, right? Or if we're going to bring people into churches today, well, we've got to do it the way the world does it, to attract people. The world is interested in just, you know, bright lights, music blaring, smoke machines maybe, and churches today are doing that. Even going as far as playing secular music. Well, if we play secular music, maybe it'll attract people from the world. If we have lights flashing, oh, it'll look like a big, you know, disco thing. I'm dating myself, but, you know, whatever those things are called. A little, somebody help me out here now. Nightclub, thank you. Disco, what's going on here? Disco is actually coming back in, so I'm actually just kind of showing my up with the trends and all. So, yeah, that's right. You know, and churches today, I've heard about smoke machines coming in now. Ooh, pastor comes out, smoke's coming, woo, you know, and everything. Worldly wisdom, guys. Don't laugh, because I'm thinking about trying that actually when we move into it. No, I'm kidding you. Come on. But seriously, I've heard about those things happening. And it saddens me, because what's happening? We're trying to do things as the world does it, or as the world thinks we need to do it. And people, even Christians, fall prey to that. Well, this is the way the world thinks it needs to be done, or how the world does it. So maybe I need to apply that to me. Instead of just saying, Lord, what are you saying to me? How are you leading me, Lord? What's your direction for my life? And we need to follow his leading. That's what we need to do. And Jesus was doing just that, following the Lord's leading in his life. He was submitting to the Father's will, wasn't he? He did this despite it seeming so weird that he would go and and act in private. His brothers couldn't fathom that. Why are you doing those things in private? Come on now. Now let's see the heart of his brothers here. His brothers were not trying to help him out. I think they were trying to maybe be sarcastic or just to try to challenge him a bit. Because it says in verse 5, for even his brothers did not believe in him. His brothers did not even believe in him. Now, I read that and I think, why would his brothers, four individuals that have grown up with this person, now as Jesus is growing up, they would have seen and heard the events of how the angels came and spoke with Mary and Joseph, that he was going to be born, conceived through the Spirit. Jesus would have grown up without sin. He would have been living that life. That would have been a perfect example. And his brothers, growing up with that, still did not believe. Now, I heard this from a pastor at the conference, and this is interesting. And I want to pose this question. Could it possibly stem from a father who began to wane in his faith? From Joseph, hearing all the rumors going around, Mary says that she was a virgin, that Jesus was born and she was still a virgin, but yet we haven't seen anything happening in Jesus' life. What's going on? And the people could have begun to murmur, could have begun to wonder and speculate and debate over this. Joseph may be hearing all these things. People thinking, Joseph, you know, what's going on? Did you cause Mary to be pregnant out of wedlock? What's happening here? And maybe as the years went on, that it just began to get so much for Joseph that he just said, forget it. I've had enough of this. I don't want to deal with this any longer. Could it be, and this is just simply speculation, I'm not trying to create some doctrine out of this, but could it be that Joseph began to simply backslide or wane from his faith, from his trust in the Lord, and begin to say, you know what, I don't know about all of this. And his brothers, now Jesus' brothers, seeing that life in Joseph, began to follow suit. And I bring that up to say this, because fathers, we have an important role to play in the house, in the home. Fathers have a certain responsibility given to them from the Lord. Now, we have fathers throughout this room, some experienced fathers, some new fathers, some who need to pull up their socks and maybe get going in fatherhood, but we'll leave that for another time. Ryan, you are not going to be able to rest. No, I'm just kidding you. But you see, fathers do have a responsibility in the home. And when fathers are not living for the Lord, chances are that the children are not going to be either. What happens when you see people, teenagers, children, who have become just so hard today, who are out on the street or involved in just crime or gangs or are doing all sorts of things? What's oftentimes your testimony? Well, my father was never home. My father was a drunk. My father abused me. All these things that a lot of times go back to the father. And I bring this up, guys, to say that as fathers, we need to realize that. And we need to be living a godly life in the home and modeling that for our kids. If we want to see our kids growing up in the things of the Lord, then show them that in your life. Demonstrate that by the things you say and by the things that you do. Now, I'm not saying that's a magic formula that all of a sudden then everything's going to be good. Well, great, my kids. You know, your children still need to make that decision. But it makes it that much more easier when they're seeing that in their fathers. And the Lord has given us that important role in the house, in the home, that we need to follow, we need to abide by. Living a godly life, demonstrating that to them. And it's very possible, because we don't hear any more of Joseph, do we? after the birth of Christ, he's really not talked about anymore, is he? Could it be that he just kind of slipped out of the picture because his faith just began to wane? Something to think about. Then Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always ready." Your time is always ready. Now again, we see that Jesus was operating on this divine timetable, wasn't he? He was not just going about his will and wanting to do what he wanted to do. He was going about the Father's will and working on his divine timetable. And John brings that up time and time again back in chapter 2. At the wedding at Cana, when Mary came to him and said, "What, you know, what business of this, is this of mine? My time's not yet come." And then throughout the book of John, we see that again and again. "My time has not yet come." He was moving along in God's will and in his timing. That's important, guys. You see, we can be following along God's will, desiring to do his will, but we can quickly get outside of his timing, can't we? And his timing is just as important. The Lord might be leading us to do something, and we can say, "Okay, that's great, Lord. I'm going to do that. Let's just," and we just go gung-ho and we say, "Now's the time. We got to do it." But it might not be the Lord's timing for that. He's got a perfect timing in mind for everything that he has in store for us to do. And everything that he has in store of what's going to happen in our lives, he's got a perfect timing for that. And we need to be careful that we are following along in his time. His timing is perfect. And we often need to exercise patience in doing that, don't we? Patience is something that people struggle with so much. Have you ever met people that are just impatient? Man, I've got a good friend who's like that. And it's funny because anything, it's just, everything's got to be chop, chop, chop. I need this then, I need that now, and chop, chop. Even on the internet. I've seen them on the internet. And, you know, sometimes pages, they take a little while to load, you know? And it's funny because sometimes you just, you know, like, "Ah, come on." He starts clicking things and it bogs things down even more and you just get impatient. Oh, it cracks me up. But that's the way we are many times. Michelle's laughing because she probably knows what I'm talking about. And people get impatient. And see, oftentimes, the Lord, what does he like to do? He likes to stretch things out, doesn't he? He wants us to exercise patience. It's one of the fruits of the Spirit, isn't it? And he brings us to that place where we feel like, "Oh man, I can't hold out any longer." But we need to just trust in him and follow his perfect timing. And that's what Jesus is doing. He says, "My time's not yet come. But for you, your time's always ready. Because you're doing things according to the way of the world." Weren't these brothers doing that? Worldly wisdom. "Man, and according to the world, any time is the right time. Just go for it, man. Doesn't matter." And he says, "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify of it that its works are evil." Just as the world hated Jesus, so the world hates him today. Why does the world hate Jesus so much? Well, he says, "Because I testify of it that its works are evil." What did Jesus do? He came to this world as a light that shines in the darkness. And what happened? People are living their lives, living in sin. Happy in doing that. Sin is fun for a season. They wanted to be accepted, living a life of sin. But Jesus came and he shone that light into the darkness. And it exposed that sin. And it showed them that what they were doing was wrong. It was sin. And people repelled from that light. I gave that illustration of when I would be working at this Bible college in the kitchen. And I'd go and flick on a light and cockroaches would just squirm all over the place. They want to get out of the light. You don't like hearing about cockroaches in kitchens, but, you know, that's the way it was. And these cockroaches just scrammed. It was like, "Light, no, I can't handle that. Get out of here." and they'd all run. And that's the reaction of people today. That light comes in. And they don't want to be confronted with their sin. They don't want to be confronted with their wrongdoing, that what they're doing is wrong, and that it does lead to death. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to know about that. So they, no, turn off that light. And they just turn to Jesus, and they hate him for it. They're angry because they want to be accepted the way that they are. They hate Jesus because he showed them the perfect way. And apart from him, they cannot have peace, can they? And so they turn the tables and they just reject him and are bitter with him and show hatred towards him. And in the same way, guys, we can expect to have that, can't we? That same reaction from people in this world. In fact, if we're living our lives and everything is just completely, completely rosy, where everything's great, oh, people just, you know, everybody's happy with me, people love me, well, maybe we need to ask ourselves, am I really shining forth that light that I need to be? Because we do know that when we shine forth that light as Jesus is the light of the world, when we are a perfect reflection of him, well, people are going to get upset at that. People will come against us and persecute us. We can be sure of that. And we should expect that. And he says in verse 8, you go up to this feast. I am not yet going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come. When he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee. Now some people, people look at this verse, and they kind of have a bit of a heyday with it. Well, Jesus, you know, he's contradicting himself. Is he caught in a lie here? He says he's not going up to this feast, but yet we're going to see later on that he did go down there in the middle of the feast. And people take this and ride with it and go, Jesus, you know, he wasn't perfect. He's caught in a bit of a lie here. And Jesus didn't contradict himself. He just simply meant that he wasn't going up at this time. That he wasn't going to go publicly and make a big spectacle and go, woo, everybody look, here's the Messiah, here I am. He was going to go quietly. And he's not contradicting himself. He's just meaning that he is not going yet at this time. But he will indeed be there. Verse 10, but when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but as it were, in secret. Now, J. Vernon McGee suggests that Jesus came down and he entered in through the sheep gate. Remember, he came in that way with the pool of Bethesda being right there at Siloam. And so, J. Vernon McGee suggests that he came into that gate quietly. It was not the regular place to go through. And he would have been able to slip through quietly. And he even suggests that Jesus would have gone through this gate every time he went into Jerusalem, except the last time when he came in for the triumphal entry. Now, if that is true, it's very fitting, isn't it? Coming into the sheep gate, the place that they would lead the sheep that come into the temple, and here is Jesus, who is the Lamb of God, to take away the sins of the world. Very fitting if that is what happened, for him to come into the sheep gate. Because he would be the final sacrifice for us all. He is the great shepherd, isn't he? Then the Jews sought him at the feast and said, where is he? There was rumblings going around. Maybe people were hearing, I think I saw him. I think he's here. And the Jews were beginning to rumble and grumble and say, he's here. Where is he? Where is that man? And they were seeking him. Why? Because they wanted to kill him, as we saw earlier. And there was much complaining among the people concerning him. Some said, he is good. Others said, no, on the contrary, he deceives the people. Now here we're getting into the middle of the feast. And we're talking about the debate that's happening. We've seen the first part before the feast, the disbelief from his brothers. Now we're looking at the debate that is beginning to take place. Some people were saying, listen, he's good. Others are saying, no way, he's a deceiver. Deceiving the people, saying that he's the Messiah. He can't be the Messiah. However, it says, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Now, as we get into this part here, we are going to be seeing, as the Jews were looking for him, this is starting now the point where the Jews are simply being consumed with anger and with a desire to end Jesus' life. This is at a place where their anger has just basically culminated, where they are just not going to rest now until they get their hands on Jesus and crucify him. This is where it begins to heat up in his life. Verse 13 is interesting. However, no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. Now, as I read this, I thought, man, how could these people, even the believers, I'm sure, at that time, how could they have been so quiet? Why couldn't they have just spoken up about Jesus? As I was thinking about that and pondering that in my head, I thought, you know what? I'm really not much different most of the time. I'm not any better than these people half the time. Now, it says that no one spoke openly of him for fear of the Jews. That word openly is better translated boldly. It's better rendered with the word boldly. No one spoke boldly of him for fear of the Jews. Now, these people, if they went and spoke favorably of Jesus, what would have happened? Well, the Jews would have come and threatened them with arrest. They could have been arrested. They would have been excommunicated from the temple. They would have no longer been able to go in the temple and worship. And this was really their life, wasn't it? For anybody to be socially outcasted like that would have been just very, very hard to deal with. It would have been a hard thing. And that's what would have happened for them if anyone spoke favorably of him. And we're going to see later on in chapter 9, I think, in a couple of weeks, man that was born blind who is made well, and the parents came in, and they were afraid to speak about Jesus healing him. They didn't want to give an account because they would have been excommunicated, sent out of the temple. And so that's the kinds of consequences that they were facing. So nobody wanted to speak boldly about him or speak in favor of him. Now, that's the consequences they face. And to a point, they could have almost felt justified in being quiet. I can't have this happen to my life. But then I look at me again, I think, what's my excuse? You know, maybe people will point the finger at me and mock me and go, aha, you know, we don't want any of that stuff. Or maybe people will call me a religious freak. You know, those are the kind of consequences we face. And it's kind of like, boo-hoo. It's nothing. It's nothing, and yet that oftentimes causes people to be silent because they don't want to face any kind of rejection. I don't want people to laugh at me. I don't want people to call me names. There goes that Jesus lover, you know, things like that. And we get all worried. What's people going to think? And it causes Christians to be silent too many times. And I simply pray that as believers we would have boldness to speak about Christ, to speak of Christ, and to share of his love. Now, Jesus did not leave us alone to that task. He sent us the Holy Spirit that would empower us and embolden us to go and share our faith with others. And we need to pray daily that the Holy Spirit would indeed fill us and empower us that we can go and testify and share the gospel, the good news, with other people, because he will give us the ability. He will be with us. He will help us. We don't need to fear as these people did. These people feared, and you could almost say they had good reason to fear, but we've got it easy. We don't have reason to fear. Now, about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and he taught. Jesus came into the temple. It was about the middle of the feast. Now, what happened the first time that he came up into Jerusalem, or the first time that's recorded? What did he do in the temple? He came in and cleansed it. There in chapter 2. And we see the order here. Jesus went in first to cleanse the temple. Then he came in to teach in the temple. You see, in order for people to be able to really begin to understand and grasp the teaching, there needed to be a cleansing that took place. That's the same thing that needs to happen in our lives. For us to truly understand the things of the Lord, there needs to be a cleansing that takes place in our life. Jesus talked about that with Nicodemus. You need to be born again to really even understand the things of heaven. Born again meant you need to be just basically born of the Spirit. See, right now, Nicodemus was thinking only in fleshly things, physical things. But Jesus was talking about being born of the Spirit, where then your mind is now open to the things of the Spirit and understanding, conceiving the things of the Spirit. And in the same way, there needs to be a cleansing that takes place in our lives. There in the temple before, people were consumed with exchanging the money, making a profit, selling the animals for the sacrifice. Their minds were on these things. Their eyes were fixed on all these things. Oh, how can I make money? And Jesus needed to come in and cleanse the temple, get rid of these things so that they could begin to hear what he was saying. And in the same way with our lives, man, we can get our eyes fixed on many things, can't we? We can get, you know, focusing on all these different things that begin to take our attention away from the truth of the Lord. And there needs to be cleansing that takes place so that our eyes are again fixed solely upon him, where we are understanding the things that he is saying to us. Now, I like the priority that Jesus gives to the word. He comes in to the temple and teaches. He didn't come into Jerusalem and say, okay, guys, let me demonstrate my power to you. Let me show you some signs and wonders. No, he gave priority to the word. He comes in and teaches the word to the people there in the temple. In the same way, we need to be quick to bypass the external things, hype. We need to be quick to bypass signs. People are seeking that in the church today. They want to see the Lord moving, and that's not a bad thing. We want to see God in all his power, sure. But people are simply seeking those things. Lord, we want to see you move. We want to see extremely incredible things happening here. We want to see signs. We want to see wonders. And what happens? The word begins to take back seat. The Lord came into the city here, and he gave priority to the word. That's what you're going to see here at Calvary Chapel Langley. Priority given to the word of God. That's what I care about. Hearing what the Lord is saying to us through his word. Being studiers of his word. Now, for some that can become dry. We need still to see the Lord move by his Spirit in our lives. I want to see that happen. I want to see the Lord do great things here. But it's always going to be balanced with the word. It's always going to line up with the word. And that's why we give priority to the word, to know what it's saying to us. And the Jews marveled, saying, how does this man know letters, having never studied? How does this man know letters? Now, the NIV says it this way, which makes it a little more clear to understand. The NIV says in verse 15, the Jews were amazed and asked, how did this man get such learning without having studied? That's what the letters really was meaning, was the learning of Scripture. How did this man get such learning without never studying? Now, in this day, rabbis would go and speak and teach primarily what they learned or what they studied from other rabbis. They would all have, there was many schools that were around in this area. And people would go to schools and they'd be taught, but they'd be taught basically what other rabbis had passed down from generation to generation. And so they'd come, and when there was an issue to deal with, when people had a question, they'd deal with it by saying, well, Rabbi so-and-so said this. Rabbi George over here, he said this. Rabbi Brandon said, you know, the perfect snowboard is one that's just going to be... And you know, they just passed down all these traditions like that. And that's how they would communicate to one another. It would just be words from other rabbis. And so they knew that Jesus had never been to one of these schools. Jesus had never sat under the teaching of one of these rabbis. And they said, where does this man get such learning? Because the words that he was sharing with them were powerful. They were truth. And Jesus says in verse 16, my doctrine is not mine, but his who sent me. Jesus simply states that his message is not from men, nor is it made up, but it comes from God. That's why they were so impressed with this message. People were saying, wow, listen to what he's saying. Because it wasn't just from another rabbi. Rabbi so-and-so said this. Jesus says, it's not made up. It's not my own. It came from the Father. It came from God. And then he says in verse 17, if anyone wills to do his will, he shall know concerning the doctrine, whether it is from God or whether I speak on my own authority. Now, listen to this here. I want you guys to get your minds around this verse. Jesus says, if anyone wills to do his will, obedience to the things of God, following his will, this leads to a spiritual understanding of the teachings of God. When we are obedient in our walk with the Lord and abiding in him, we're following his will. That leads way to spiritual understanding to the things of God. The Jewish leaders, they were stubborn. And they were not willing to submit to Jesus, were they? And they were unable to see the light and recognize his teaching. They didn't follow his will. And what happened? They did not want anything to do with his teaching. They rejected it. Now, Jesus is speaking more about a personal commitment to walking with him. What happens, guys, is when we are walking with him and abiding in him, what happens? We experience that truth, don't we? We are experiencing that truth. And then we know, and that's what he's saying here. He shall know concerning the doctrine, whether it is from God, or whether it is from, or whether I speak on my own authority. When we are walking, abiding with him, we begin to experience that truth. We begin to have spiritual understanding. I think Nicodemus began to follow after Christ with this commitment. And he began to see the light. We know that in the end, we believe Nicodemus became born again. But it was as he was beginning to commit to him and walk with him. G. Campbell Morgan says this, when men are wholly, completely consecrated to the will of God and want to do that above everything else, then they find out that Christ's teaching is divine, that it is the teaching of God. Psalm 111 verse 10 says this, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all those who do his commandments. His praise endures forever. A good understanding have all those who follow his commandments. That's the key, guys. And Jesus says, listen, you question, you challenge my teaching, those people who follow my will, who are walking in commitment with me, they are experiencing the truth. They know that what I say is true. And then he says in verse 18, he who speaks from himself seeks his own glory, but he who seeks the glory of the one who sent him is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. He who speaks of himself or from himself seeks his own glory. Jesus was not looking to glorify himself. Thus, he was not speaking from himself. He was seeking to bring glory to the Father. And thus, he spoke truth. And he was truth. Now, cults. What happens with cults? A lot of times, these are formed by man's teaching. By people making up something. This is what you need to follow. And what happens in cults? An individual is oftentimes exalted or glorified. people look to that individual and say, oh, this guy's incredible, this guy's great. And a lot of times, if you want to know if something is of God or is not of God, look to see if they are bringing glory to themselves or if they're bringing glory to God. He says, those who seek the glory of the one who sent him is true, and no unrighteousness is in him. And that is speaking ultimately of Christ, isn't it? Did not Moses give you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me? The people answered and said, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? Jesus answered and said to them, I did one work, and you all marvel. Now, the law was unable to be fulfilled by man. And Jesus would have said something there that would have really rubbed these people the wrong way, wouldn't it have? He says, Moses gives the law, yet none of you keeps the law. These Jewish and the Pharisees, they prided themselves in keeping the law. But no man was able fully to keep the law. Why was the law given? The law was given to show God's standard of righteousness, didn't it? It showed his standard of righteousness. Paul says in Galatians 3:19, it says, what purpose then does the law serve? It was added because of transgressions, till the seed should come to whom the promise was made, and it was appointed through angels by the hand of a mediator. Now a mediator does not mediate for one only, but God is one. Is the law then against the promises of God? Certainly not. For if there had been a law given which could have given life, truly righteousness would have been by the law. Therefore the law was our tutor to bring us to Christ. That was the purpose of the law, to lead us to Christ, to show us that we could not do it ourselves, that we needed something greater. We needed Jesus Christ, that we might be justified by faith, it goes on to say. But after faith has come, we are no longer under a tutor. We are no longer under the law. We're not bound to the law. But the law was brought to show us that we needed something greater, and it led us to Christ. Peter spoke at the first council in Jerusalem in Acts 15, and he said to the people, our fathers and us were unable to bear the yoke of that law. It was a yoke that was unable to be carried. And Jesus asked them, and he says this, if you do not keep the law, why do you seek to kill me? If you don't keep the law, why are you after me? You are challenging me that I'm not keeping the law? And the people answered and said, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? They thought, you've gone mad. Who's seeking to kill you? Now, the people there in the temple were not very aware of the conspiracy that was going around with the Jewish authorities, with the Pharisees, of trying to kill Jesus. They were not aware of that, and they were thinking, who's trying to... You've gone mad. You must be possessed. Who's trying to kill you? And Jesus answered and said to them, I did one work, and you all marvel. Now, Jesus did more than one work, didn't he? But he's talking about the healing of the man by the pool of Bethesda. The healing of the paralytic that was done on the Sabbath, because that is what irritated them. This is what got their blood boiling, that he did this healing on the Sabbath. And that's what this is revolving around. And Jesus said, I did one work. And that's why he says, you don't keep the law, yet you're trying to kill me because you think I broke the Sabbath? You think I broke the law? And he says, Moses, therefore, gave you circumcision. Not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers. Meaning that this preceded Moses. It came from Abraham. Circumcision. And he says, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If a man receives circumcision on the Sabbath, so that the law of Moses should not be broken, are you angry with me because I made a man completely well on the Sabbath? Jesus is saying this. You guys go. The law required in that day that the boy had to be circumcised on the eighth day. Now, of course, the eighth day would oftentimes land on the Sabbath day. And Jesus says, if you go in and do this on the Sabbath, just so that you're not breaking the law, you would go and get mad at me for actually making a man whole. You go and, as Paul would say, mutilate the flesh. You go and do this, and I go and make a person whole on the Sabbath. Yet you say that I'm wrong. The legalists, you see, what was happening? They were destroying flesh. Jesus was making it whole. He was healing it. Yet they were so caught up in their traditions and rules to see the work of God. It's interesting that circumcision was the one thing that was really, that stood out for being people that were following the law. The law was religion, isn't it? Interesting how circumcision is the one thing that stood out. A very painful thing. And isn't that a picture of what religion is like? Religion is uncomfortable. It can be painful because you're trying to follow all these rules and regulations. It's not enjoyable. Circumcision, guys, not enjoyable. I'm sure I don't need to tell you that. But that is a picture of what religion does. There was a young boy who was going into hospital to have his tonsils removed. He told his playmate, I'm going to be gone for a while. I have to go have surgery. Now, on the day he was admitted, his mother asked the doctor, could you please circumcise him while he's asleep? And the doctor agreed. So the boy woke up and was very sore down there for several days. After about a week, he got to see his playmate again. The playmate informed him that he was also going to have his tonsils out soon. And he asked his friend to tell him about the surgery. The little boy replied, all I can tell you is your tonsils ain't where you think they are. He was very sore. And circumcision. It is a picture of what religion does for people. It binds them. It leaves them uncomfortable, painful. Jesus came to make people whole, to set them free from those things, to give them new life. That's what Jesus came to do. And he says, if I do that on the Sabbath, and you go and destroy flesh, how could you get angry with me? And then he says, do not judge according to appearance, but judge with righteous judgment. The people here, they were looking only on the surface of things. And they were not being objective in their judgment. They were looking at what Jesus did and said, listen, he's going against our traditions. He's going against what we've taught, that you cannot do nothing on the Sabbath. He's going against that. And they were looking at the externals on the surface of things instead of looking more deeply. Instead of judging with righteous judgment, understanding, listen, Jesus is doing a good work. This man who was an invalid for, how long was it? 38 years, I think it was. 38 years. Who's been waiting to get in that pool. He's also been made whole. Why couldn't they have looked at that and said, you know what? That's a good thing. Wow, that's exciting. That's wonderful. But instead, they were judging according to appearance. They were saying, that's breaking our rules. They're doing that on the Sabbath. That can't be. And they sought to kill Jesus. And you know, we too need to guard ourselves from judging based on externals. Instead of looking at something and saying, that can't be right. That doesn't look right. That's wrong. We need to allow the Lord to give us insight into those things and base it upon His righteousness and grace. You know, people used to judge on the externals and by appearance. Back in the 60s when people were being saved, weren't they? That guy, he's got long hair. He's got tattoos. He can't be saved. That's not right. You got to have short hair. You got to look good. You got to dress right. and people would judge based on appearances. But Jesus says, judge with righteous judgment. Judge with grace. Jesus looked upon those people and he loved them. He said, just come unto me. Come unto me and you will be saved. Doesn't matter what you look like. Doesn't matter what you are wearing. Just come unto me as you are. That's judging with righteous judgment, looking at it through the Lord's eyes. And we can oftentimes see things that don't go the way we think it should. And we judge it based on appearances, based on the externals. Instead, look at things through the Lord's eyes. Judge with righteous judgment. That's what the Lord does. And I'm thankful that that's what he did in my life. That he showed that grace. He loved us. And he didn't judge us based on what he saw. He judged us based on his righteousness, didn't he? We were all sinners. We were all filthy. And Jesus could have easily, God could have easily looked down and said, those guys don't deserve that. But he judged us based on Jesus' righteousness. And for that, guys, I'm just so glad, so thankful. And we can leave here today knowing that though we may not feel good all the time, God sees us not as we see us, but he sees us as Christ is, because that's the righteousness that we're judged with. Good to know, isn't it? May we do the same in people around us, in the things that we see. We're going to end there. Next week we'll continue on with this debate that was taking place at the middle of the feast, and then we'll look at the end of the feast and see the division that began to occur. Let's pray.